Skateboarding has a long and complex history. It has evolved from a little-known hobby, practiced by California teenagers in the 1970s, to a popular international sport. Today, Central Coast resident and retired skateboard champion Jack Smith showcases that rich history at the Morro Bay Skateboard Museum. Established in 2014, the museum has relics from all of the great ages of skateboarding, from 1920 scooters to the world's second largest skateboard. I'm correspondent Rebecca Nolan. Come along and join me as I talk to Mr. Smith about the history of skateboarding and his plan to skateboard across the country for the fourth time this September. I am here today with Jack Smith in his skateboard museum here in Morro Bay, California. Hi, Jack. How are you doing?
Good. And you?
I'm doing well. Can you tell me what inspired you to open a skateboard museum in Morro Bay?
Well, I've been involved in skateboarding since the early 70s, first as just a skater and then as a competitor, and worked in the industry for a long time and started collecting boards in 1988. And about 4 years ago, I asked my wife, what do you think of a skateboard museum? She said, go for it. So here we are 4 years later with a skateboard museum.
And what first got you interested in skateboarding?
Well, I found a skateboard in my friend's backyard the day after I graduated from high school in 1974 and never looked back since then.
And did you learn how to skateboard here in Morro Bay?
Yes. It was the summer I graduated from Morro Bay High School. Myself and my buddies made some homemade boards. Started skating around town, and we were actually on clay wheels at that point. We didn't even know urethane wheels had been invented. And then we discovered urethane wheels, and it opened up a whole new ball game to what you could skate. You could skate on rough surfaces. You could skate in empty swimming pools and ditches. So it was just a big playground for us.
And that's really interesting to me, the evolution of the materials that go into skateboards. How have you seen that change over the years?
The biggest change ever in skateboarding was when it went from clay wheels to urethane wheels in about 1972. It just made skateboards work. It made it really fun. In the clay wheel days, and even in the early urethane days, wheels had what are called loose ball bearings. You had actually 16 bearings per wheel, so 64 bearings per board. You get four wheels. And this is what they sounded like. That's a clay wheel with loose ball, and then here's a urethane, which the sound isn't much different. And then you went to wheels that had sealed bearings, and this happened about 1975. Silent. And I remember when I got my first set of sealed bearings, I spun them, and they didn't spin that well. And I was like, what's the big deal? And the guy who was giving them to me said, wait till you stand on them, because they really don't work until you stand on them. And the best thing was, the two best things, one, they were faster, and the second best thing was you didn't have to drop 64 bearings into your skateboard wheels. You know, you'd be out on the old loose ball bearing wheels, and you'd be riding along, and they'd fall out. So you always had to carry around a bunch of bearings in your pocket so you could fix your board. And then some other changes, big changes, of course, were people started making trucks just for skateboarding rather than using roller skate trucks. And then the board materials, instead of having a solid board, you had a board made out of ply. Some people use fiberglass, other exotic materials. Now you see some boards that are made of carbon fiber. So it just keeps evolving.
What have you found to be your favorite kind of skateboard material and skateboard to use?
Well, nowadays I'm riding some pretty exotic material skateboards, mainly because I ride longboards and there's a lot of technical innovation in the longboard world right now. So I really like the new technology, the carbon fiber materials. Some of the trucks are made out of, they're actually machined rather than molded. So it's just ongoing.
That's so cool. Can you tell me about Signal Hill and what was going on there back in the day?
Well, Signal Hill was it's a very steep hill in the Long Beach area. And it was the site of the first World Speed Championships in 1975.
Starting in 1975, a ragtag group of surfers, skateboarders, hang gliders, and hot rod mechanics started meeting at a steep drop of roughly paved asphalt, appropriately named Hill Street. chasing a prize that wouldn't come close to covering medical expenses. They dropped over the steep precipice on primitive skateboards.
First year, there's only a couple guys entered. The next year, there was, probably 25. By the time I raced there in 1978, there were probably close to 60, 65 competitors. Some guys raced on just regular skateboards, downhill boards. I raced in the modified division that was actually called skate cars. My vehicle was something that I laid down head first on, or actually I should say in, because there was an aerodynamic shell over me, and went head first down the hill at about 60 miles an hour.
Whoa, and how many times did you do that?
We only raced the car at two different races. One was at Signal Hill, and the other one was at Soapbox Derby Track back in Akron, Ohio. And they stopped it after 1978 because so many of the vehicles were just poorly constructed, had a lot of control issues. I was one of the lucky few who, the guys who built my car did a great job, and I never had any problems.
What makes a skate car different than a skateboard?
A skate car is a lay-down vehicle. You can either lay down head first or feet first. They usually have aerodynamic bodies over them. It's still like a skateboard in that it's lean-controlled. You don't have a steering wheel or anything. So it's lean-controlled. You have brakes and a parachute. It was just kind of an offshoot of skateboard racing in the late 70s.
And what drew you to that versus like a standard skateboard?
Well, when I was a kid, my dream was to be a race car driver. Never had the money to do that. When I saw skate cars in 1977, I said, I have to do that. Luckily, I fell in with a mechanical engineering student from Cal Poly who designed and built the chassis of the car. And then we approached Vedder Fairings, which was a motorcycle fairing company in San Luis Obispo at the time. And they agreed to get involved and make us the fairing for it. All told, we spent about $6,000 building and racing the car, and we were chasing a $1,000 first place prize, and we ended up with the $25 trophy for second place.
But you still sounds like you had a lot of fun doing it.
Yeah, it was a very fun time of my life.
Also, I understand that you are a skateboard champion. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, I've won a few contests over the years, mainly local events. And I've won a couple slalom races, regional slalom races. At Signal Hill, I took second. At the Akron race, I took second. So combined in 1978, I was the overall world skate car champion.
So now it's 40 years later from that, and you're still skateboarding. And you are about to do something that's really cool. Can you tell us something about that?
Yeah, I've skateboarded across America as part of a relay team four times, but this coming September, I'll be starting on another journey across America, but this time on an electric skateboard.
Why change to an electric skateboard at this point?
I've always enjoyed the new technologies. Also, I'm 59 years old. I've always wanted to do it solo. I've never had the time to do that because it would take, 2 to 3 months to do it that way. On an electric board, I think I can do it in about 25 to 30 days. And I've just always liked adventure.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the adventures you've had during those skateboardings across America?
Oh, there's just so many to mention. The first time we did it, it was myself and two friends from Morro Bay. And we did it because we didn't want to work in a restaurant that summer. And we were lucky enough to get a sponsor. And we really just found an old atlas and traced out our route, and off we went. And usually the best part of all the trips have been the people we've met.
Can you tell me about some of those people?
Probably the most interesting thing, and it was very scary actually for a while. In 1984, we were just outside of Yellowstone Park, and we came to a bridge, and there was a woman flagging us down, flagging our van down. And we stopped and got out, and about that time a cowboy looking guy came up out of the creek bed with a little girl, 2-year-old girl in his arms that had basically drowned, and she thought we were the ambulance. So we threw them in the car and took off towards Cody, Wyoming to get them to the hospital. And by that time they'd got the baby breathing again. And then we saw a sheriff car coming, so we blocked the road with our van to get the sheriff to stop, because we figured he could get the little girl to the hospital quicker. The little girl stopped breathing again. So they got her out on the side of the road. They were doing CPR. About that time, a doctor on his way to Yellowstone on vacation drove up, and he jumped out and got involved. And then finally the ambulance did show up, and they got her in the ambulance and took her down to Cody. So eventually we made our way to Cody that evening, skating another 40 miles. And when we got there, we saw the mom of the daughter coming out of the hospital. And she said that it was still touch and go. They were putting her daughter on a helicopter to Salt Lake City. And that's the last we ever heard about it until about 2 years ago. One of the guys on the trip was cleaning out his house, and he found a newspaper article about when we were in Cody, Wyoming. And in the article, the little girl's name was mentioned, her family name. So he started doing some searching around on Google, and he found a young woman in Utah that was about the right age, same name, sent her an email. Didn't hear anything for months. Finally, one day, he gets an email. I'm getting goosebumps now. But he gets an email, and it's from this woman, and she says that it was really ironic that she received the email from him, because she was only reason she went on that account that day was to close it because she wasn't using it anymore. And it turns out she was the little girl that was rescued that day. Didn't have any adverse effects, went on to a good life, was a writer for a local newspaper, and actually was her first novel was being published that summer. And so that was it was good to find out, to get some closure on that. But it was just such an interesting situation, because we usually start skating at around 7 in the morning. Well, that morning we were on the west side of Yellowstone. It rained. We had to wait 3 hours before we started. So we skate to Yellowstone. We start skating through Yellowstone. We get stopped 9 miles in because you're not allowed to skate in Yellowstone. So we figure, all right, let's go see Old Faithful. So we go over to see Old Faithful. It had just went off. So we walked around, came back to watch Old Faithful, missed it again. So then we just sat for another hour until it went off. And then we drove through Yellowstone and eventually got outside of Yellowstone and started skating. So all these things lined up to put us there at the perfect time to have her us show up when they needed help. And it's just it was very moving to get her letter and find out that she was okay.
Amazing. It sounds like you got a lot of experience with interacting with people from all across the country.
Yeah, and all different types of people, especially the early trips. It's really interesting. In 76, people were just fascinated. They'd see us and, what are you guys doing? What is that thing you're riding? By the time 2013 came around, people didn't give us a second look. You know, it was like, ah, oh, there's a guy on a skateboard out in the middle of South Dakota with no one else around. You know, it was like they'd seen it before or something.
And now, do you think you could give us a little walking tour of the museum?
Yep, okay.
Cool. Where do you think is a good place to start?
We're starting at the 50s.
Okay,
here we are in the late 50s, early 60s section. As you can see, most of the boards here are fairly small. Skateboards in the 60s were really considered to be a kid's toy. There wasn't a whole lot of performance. There were people who could ride them very well, but with the steel wheels and then the clay wheels, you had to have really smooth surfaces. Any little pebble or crack you hit, the board would just stop and you would keep going. So skateboarding, you know, it's been around since the 30s, really, when kids were riding scooters, and the scooters, the boxes would break off, the handles would break off, or the kids would just break it off and they'd still ride the board. It got popularized in the late 1950s, early 60s by surfers, as something to do when the waves weren't very good. But by 1965, skateboarding was dead. There was a Surgeon General's report that came out about how dangerous skateboards were. So overnight, skateboarding died. And it really, there wasn't much going on in the skateboard world until about 1972, when a fellow named Frank Nasworthy came up with the idea to adapt urethane wheels to skateboards. In the 1970s, we have boards started off, they were still kind of narrow. They were still using roller skate trucks, but then the urethane wheel happened. So boards started getting a little longer. There's a little bit more performance. You had a little bit more stability with a longer board. And when people discovered they could ride in swimming pools, the board started getting wider. And then people started experimenting with, well, it's just instead of a solid oak board, let's make one out of a Canadian maple plywood and see what happens. And then the kicktail came along, which allowed you more maneuverability. Trucks got wider. Wheels got bigger. So throughout the 70s, there was a great deal of innovation, lots of experimentation, different materials, different formulas of urethane in the wheels. So the 70s was really, to me, the golden era of skateboarding.
And why do you think that was?
Well, I just, because I was there and I experienced it, and I feel really lucky to have been involved. I've been around to experience that change from clay to urethane, because it was just so amazing. I can still remember the first night I rode urethane wheels. It was just groundbreaking. And then, like I said, there was just so much innovation going on, and to be part of that innovation and see it happen firsthand was just very special.
Can you talk to me about this picture here?
Yeah, we're looking at a picture here of a fellow named Greg Weaver, who was a surfer, but also a skateboarder. And he was a very stylish skateboarder, and he appeared in some of the first ads for Cadillac Wheels, which was the first urethane wheel company. And I always like to say this is the picture that launched 1,000 kids, 1 million kids into skateboarding, because quintessential California kid, you know, shorts, T-shirt, barefoot, long blonde hair, just styling. This is at a hill in Southern California, San Diego area called La Costa. And everybody wanted to be Greg Weaver. We'd go out and skate, and people would say, hey, do a Weaver, you know, and that's what he's doing, a low driving turn.
So we're going to go a little bit more back in time, and I've noticed these little scooters here. So can you tell about the connection between scooters and skateboards?
Yeah, scooters have been around since probably the early 1900s. We have one here donated by a local police volunteer, Ken Westerfeldt, that's from the 1920s. And then we have 30s, 40s, into the 50s scooters. And really, you know, a lot of people say, oh, skateboarding came from surfing. Well, really, skateboarding came from scooters. A lot of these you can see have handles. Well, sometimes a handle would break off. You know, kids weren't great at building stuff, you know, so they'd fall off. Or sometimes just take them off and ride the board. And that was truly where skateboarding came from. I mean, you take this handle off and you have a skateboard. Also in this cabinet here, we have a skateboarder lunchbox with thermos, which was quite interesting. The company Aladdin sold hundreds of thousands of these. The unfortunate part is you see the images on here of different skaters. Those are actually friends of mine who Aladdin stole their pictures out of the skateboard magazines, changed them a little bit, and these guys never got paid a dime for it.
Wow.
Yeah. And a lot of people look at this board here and relate it to the Mars Rover board, but actually it's a very earthbound company who made it. It's BMW made this skateboard back in the early 2000s, mid-2000s. If you bought a certain model BMW, this board was in the trunk. And I believe there are only about 300 made. And it's very different than a regular skateboard in the way it turns. It has articulating suspension. But people just love the fact that BMW made a skateboard.
So tell us about this big thing. It's like a beast of a skateboard.
Yes, this is the second biggest skateboard in the world. It was built in the early 2000s by a company called Foundation Skateboards, owned by Todd Swank. He just got a wild hair one day and wanted to have the biggest skateboard in the world. And this was the biggest skateboard in the world until about, I'm guessing, 2009. It was in the Guinness Book of World Records. We borrowed it in 2014 for our grand opening. And Todd's just said, keep it, you know. The four boards on this wall are the boards I've used on the different cross-country trips starting back in 1976. This is actually just a replica of the board I actually used, because the board I used is in the Smithsonian now. So you can see it's very small. It's about the size of what kids ride today, the penny boards, which are very popular plastic boards. As you can see, the wheels were very small. A lot of the younger guys come in that do long-distance skating, and they look at this and go, how did you do that? How did you skate across country? We didn't know any better. That was the best there was at the time. Then in 1984, when we did it, this is a little, as you can see, it's a little bit longer, bigger wheels, wider trucks, made it much easier. 1976, it took us 32 days. 1984, we had four guys instead of three. We did it in 26 days.
And what makes the difference for you as a rider for these two kinds of boards?
really, when you have a longer board, it's more stable. We had bigger wheels that were much better technology. They were more resilient, more rebound, had better bearings, of course. So that's really the big difference between these two. And then you get to 2003 when we did it, and we have a board that's specifically designed for long-distance skating. This board is actually made in Leipzig, Germany. It's carbon fiber. As you can see, it has fenders. It has very large wheels, which help to roll over rough rougher surfaces. Super lightweight.
Going back to that one, can you tell me about the picture of the little boy on
there?
Sure.
The little boy on the board here, we actually had six of these boards. And each skater, there was four skaters on the team, each board had this photo here. This is a photo of my son, Jack Marshall Smith, who was born in 1988 with a very rare genetic syndrome called Lowe syndrome. There's only about 350 known cases in the world. And Jack passed away from Lowe syndrome in 2013. And that's why we did this trip, was to raise awareness of Lowe syndrome and to also raise research funds. So that's why his picture's there. It was very inspiring to myself as well as the other skaters. You'd be going up a mountain and think you had it rough, and you'd look down and see Jack, and you realize, this isn't so hard. So then we move on to 2013, another board specifically designed for long distance. This was made specially for us by a company from Canada called Rain. They made us a bunch of these. We rode on a few of them, and then the rest of them we sold to help raise funds for the trip. This trip was done in kind of honor of my father, and also to help raise awareness and also research funds for Alzheimer's. My dad had Alzheimer's, unfortunately. And here we've got some shoes hanging here, Vans that I wore. I think these made it from Oregon to Madison, Wisconsin, before they wore a hole in them. So those are the four boards I've used on the cross-country trip, and as you can see, they're very different.
And so earlier you said that the original board that you had gotten the Smithsonian. How did that happen?
There's a woman that works at the Smithsonian, Jane Rogers, who is in charge of building up their skateboard collection for the American History Museum. And she saw it on Facebook, and she said, hey, we'd love to have your board that you rode across country in 1976 on as part of our collection. So, of course, I said yes. It's interesting, though, when you donate something to the Smithsonian, you actually have to sign a deed. It belongs to them. It doesn't come back. And then what's really cool is when they heard we were doing the trip again in 2013, they contacted us and said, hey, we'd like a board from that trip as well. And I said, great. So when we got done with the trip, we took a trip we drove from New York City down to Washington, D.C., and gave him my son's board. So myself and my son both have a board in the Smithsonian now. And it was just a neat experience to go there because the boards aren't on display yet. They're in their archive section. But they took us back in the archives. And for me, it was really neat. Jane said, would you like to see where your board's at? And I said, of course. And so she opens up this cabinet. And there's Tony Hawk's first skateboard, and right next to it is my first skateboard, my cross-country board, so pretty good company. And then it was fun, because then she started showing us all this, Babe Ruth's uniform, Michael Jordan's uniform, the costume that the Scarecrow wore in Wizard of Oz, and to see all these things that, touchstones of when I was growing up, and to know that something of mine is in there. I mean, I could have never dreamed when I started skateboarding that something I used would be in the Smithsonian. It's sometimes when I tell people about it, I start laughing because I still can't believe it.
And if somebody wanted to learn more about this, where should they go?
Well, online, you can check us out at mbskate.com. That's the museum website. You can also find us on Facebook. Just type in Morro Bay Skateboard Museum and we'll pop up. You can find us on TripAdvisor. The actual museum is located at 699 Embarcadero. We're open 7 days a week, summer hours 10 to 6, and winter hours 12 to 5.
Thanks so much, Jack, and good luck on your cross-country trip that's coming up.
All right, thank you very much.
You've been listening to correspondent Rebecca Nolan reporting from Morro Bay, California, at the Morro Bay Skateboard Museum, where she's been visiting with owner Jack Smith.
Burn, 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 till the dirt takes a deeper away. You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomascwilmer.com. Our associate producers from the San Francisco Bay Area include Molly Blaisdell, Lori King, and Susie Rodriguez. Melissa Corbin reporting from Knoxville, Tennessee, Rebecca Nolan, Newfoundland, Canada, Kim Schneider from Michigan, Elaine Masters in San Diego, Julie Henning, Eugene, Oregon, Rebecca Bingham, Hot Springs, Arkansas, and Steve Cook contributing from Little Rock, Arkansas, host of Arkansongs on NPR affiliate KUAR.